from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Much of the Canadian capital of Ottawa was on lockdown Wednesday for a manhunt seeking one or more armed assailants thought connected to shootings at three different sites in the city, including the Canadian Parliament and the National War Memorial. According to authorities late Wednesday, the shootings left one soldier dead and at least two other people injured with non-life-threatening injuries. Police say one gunman was shot and killed by officers. At least one gunman was thought to be still at large. No motive for the shootings has yet been identified. Wednesday's shootings came a day after another Canadian soldier died in a road accident that some Canadian media claim may have been caused by someone they're calling an Islamic militant. The two incidents follow Canada's decision to join the U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State. The body of Serena Shim, the American journalist killed Sunday when her car was rammed by a cement truck in Turkey, arrived Wednesday in Beirut, Lebanon, her final resting place. We have this report from Press TV.
The body of Press TV's correspondent Serena Shim, who was killed in a car crash in Turkey, has returned to her children in her home country of Lebanon. Serena Shim's funeral is scheduled to be held on Wednesday afternoon. She and her camerawoman were returning from a report scene in the village of Suruj. Let's now speak to our correspondent in Beirut, Lamis Qaroot, who joins us via Skype. Lamis, it's obviously an emotional time for Serena's family, for us who are her colleagues. Just walk us through about the proceedings.
Yes, definitely very, very, very emotional, too much pain. We do know her body has arrived just as we speak to Beirut International Airport here in the Lebanese capital. Her family, as well as some members from the Press TV Beirut's Bureau, have headed to the airport to receive the body. Her body is going directly from the airport to a hospital in Beirut near her hometown in Birjel Barajne. From there, the family in the morning is going to continue to acceptance condolence at the house, at Serena's house. As you noted, today, 4 p.m. Beirut time, the funeral is going to take place. The funeral is going to take place in her hometown named Birjel Barajne, and that is in the Dahi suburbs here in Beirut. After the funeral, the family is going to continue to accept condolences. They're going to have yet another memorial service that's going to take place at Serena's father's house. I actually headed out to one of the memorial services a few days ago. Just so heartbreaking. Her family is so shocked, as us all. We're all shocked as well. She has two little kids who don't know anything yet. Of course, they don't know that mommy has passed away. They're still promised that mommy's coming back next week to visit them. So it's really such an emotional time for her family. I mean, for us all, and we're all still in utter shock, if you want, and definitely her family. I mean, her father was speechless. He really had no words to tell us other than, my daughter is a resistance fighter who died for the truth. It's so shocking, really. It's so shocking for us all.
Right, Lemus, as you mentioned, you met her family, her children specifically, who are just too young right now to even comprehend the loss that we're all suffering right now with Serena's death. But she has also become a symbol, not in just the world of journalism, but I'm sure in Lebanon as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely, definitely, 100%. That's one thing actually her family said. They said, you know, maybe her death is a little suspicious or a little fishy, but they say at the same time, she really, she made us proud and she gave dignity to the family. You know, she's someone who left so much behind for this job. You know, she left her family, she left her kids, she left her house, she left her country, you know, and she went to all these dangerous places, these war zones, if you want, to really give the name of the truth. And yes, of course, lots of TV stations in Beirut as well were so upset when they found out the news, because she was also well known here amongst journalists in Beirut too. So it's just really a sad scene, and may God bless her soul.
May God indeed. And Lemis, as we speak to you and throughout, ever since Serena's death's news broke out, we've been receiving condolence messages and solidarity from our viewers as well, who were following Serena when she was reporting from, be it from Beirut, be it from Damascus, or from Donetsk, or the Syrian-Turkey border. It is quite huge to see the way these emotions are pouring out from people across the world.
Yes, definitely, 100%, definitely. Because at the same time, you know, the message that she sent out in the message of truth, and, you know, it's very hard to find true journalism today. And just her scenario, you know, half the time her family lived here in Beirut while, or I'm speaking about her husband and her kids, while she was still abroad. So she was really such a brave woman, and she gave up so much for her job. And anyone, I honestly don't know Serena too well. I only met her a few times, because when I started at Beirut's Barrel, she was already doing corresponding outside Beirut's Barrel. But I do know of her, and I used to always hear stuff about her. And she was someone that really was willing to give up so much for her work and so much for her field work. And she really, you could tell she was so passionate about her career, and she really loved her career. And I think that also, that's really also what made so many people like her. And when so many people here in Lebanon also found out about her death, they were just so devastated, because many say she had such a bright future. You know, she was so young and she was able to accomplish all those things. I mean, really only God knows what was in store for her, for, you know, in the future. But may God bless her soul.
As of press time Wednesday, the Turkish government had still not released the details of the incident, including the identity of the truck driver. Shim had provided war zone coverage for Press TV in Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey, and Ukraine. Some of her reports were carried here. Syria's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Bashar al-Ja'afari, issued a call to the UN Tuesday to punish what he called, quote, the terrorist coalition of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Israel, closed quote. At Tuesday's Security Council session, Ambassador al-Ja'afari said the coalition has been seeking to destroy Syria by fanning the flames of terrorism and shedding the blood of the Syrian people. We have this report from Press TV.
Syria's ambassador to the United Nations says time has come for the world body to punish, quote, the terrorist coalition of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Israel. At a UN Security Council session, Bashar al-Ja'afari said the coalition has been seeking to destroy Syria through terrorism and shedding Syrian blood. Syria has been gripped by over 3 years of deadly insurgency, which has wreaked havoc on the country. Damascus has repeatedly accused Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Israel of plotting and fanning the flames of the insurgency, which has so far killed tens of thousands of people. The Syrian ambassador to the UN also said the same coalition is trying to kill the Palestinian cause and protect Tel Aviv from the consequences of its crimes.
Syria has been gripped by deadly violence since 2011. The U.S. and its regional allies, especially Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, have been actively supporting the anti-government fighters in the country. The U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights has reported that more than 200,000 people have died in the Syrian conflict since March of 2011. In Hong Kong, an anti-Occupy Central group called the Alliance for Peace and Democracy launched a petition campaign seeking to, in their words, take back Hong Kong's streets and roads from the anti-government protesters. They'll be collecting signatures for 9 days. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
Among this group of the anti-Occupy demonstrators, bus and taxi drivers have been the most vocal, as their jobs and incomes have been hit hardest. Regular workers in Hong Kong also say longer commuting times have caused huge losses in their wages, as this group of people are being paid by hours. And it is not just the blue-collar worker feeling the pinch. Those working in finance have also warned that the protests will scare away foreign investors, which could have a long-term impact on Hong Kong's economy.
At a news conference Wednesday afternoon, the Alliance said that they would begin collecting signatures for 9 days, beginning October 25th to November 2nd, People opposed to the Occupy movement can sign the petition either at stations around the city or online. The Anti-Occupy Alliance organizer, Joel Wrong, said the petition just is the first action and there will be others to follow. Meanwhile, Hong Kong police say they have arrested 94 Occupy Central protesters as of Tuesday for disrupting public order.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
That was then President John F. Kennedy, 50 years ago Wednesday, on October 22, 1962, as he began a televised address to the nation announcing the discovery of Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba. Kennedy announced that he was ordering a naval quarantine of Cuba to prevent Soviet ships from transporting any more weapons to the island, and he said the United States would not tolerate the existence of the missile sites currently in place. He made it clear that the U.S. would not stop short of military action to force the removal of the weapons. Over the next 6 days, the crisis escalated almost to the breaking point, with the world tottering on the brink of nuclear war between the two superpowers. People in both the U.S. and the USSR lived for years thereafter with the threat of nuclear war hanging over them. That danger appeared to recede with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. But recent tensions between the U.S. and the Russian Federation have again raised concerns that the two nuclear powers could, at some point, come to blows. To discuss this, we spoke with Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition. He spoke with us by telephone from Washington, D.C., Wednesday.
I do remember it as well. I was 10 at the time. The country and the world were suddenly at the brink of thermonuclear war. That's what it appeared to be. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as we know now, had voted unanimously at the time to recommend a full-scale invasion of Cuba. And given the fact that Cuba not only possessed the beginnings or some Soviet intermediate and short-range nuclear weapons, but also had essentially a protective umbrella over the island at that point as a consequence of a treaty between Cuba and the Soviet Union, it appeared that the United States was going to carry out actions that would lead to thermonuclear war. And in fact, if it hadn't been for the restraint of Kennedy in the face of the military, and he, you know, later described the military based on that experience, he said the military is mad.
Yeah.
Meaning that they would be prepared to carry out thermonuclear war. Right. And because Khrushchev, in essence, capitulated at the last moment, if it hadn't been for those two factors, I believe we would have had the unthinkable, a thermonuclear war by two countries that possessed enormous nuclear arsenals. The United States arsenal was considerably larger than the Soviet arsenal. The U.S. had 17 times as many strategic nuclear weapons, and its fleet of B-52 bombers, which were nuclear capable, were able to reach all kinds of Soviet targets. The Soviets had nothing equivalent to it. And the U.S. had placed intermediate and short-range missiles both in Turkey and in Italy, in other words, surrounding the Soviet Union with missiles, nuclear missiles targeting Moscow that could have hit their targets in 10 minutes.
Right.
The Pentagon thought, well, these are the advantages. A thermonuclear war is going to happen anyway. Let's do it now. Let's not wait, because the Soviets, step by step, were catching up with the Americans. So it appeared that there might be a very real possibility of thermonuclear war. But again, as I said, Khrushchev at the last minute blinked. He capitulated, agreed to remove the missiles from Cuba. And the Kennedy administration, Kennedy himself and his brother, had acted in the week or 10 days prior to that as a something of a restraint on the Pentagon, which wanted to, the Pentagon hawks just wanted to get the war going.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you consider Kennedy's assassination a year later in that context, it's kind of scary, too. But the policies, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, or in any event, the you know, the end of the Soviet Union 24 years ago or whatever, it seemed like that threat of a global confrontation between two nuclear armed powers had gone away. But it seems the United States is doing everything it can again to bring relations between the U.S. and Russia to that point. What's up with this?
Well, you know, there's a fundamental difference between the so-called Cold War that went on, you know, almost immediately after the end of World War II, where the Soviets and the United States and Britain had been primary allies with each other. That so-called Cold War went from 1946, and Truman issued the Iron Curtain speech from Missouri in 46. All the way up until the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was in 1991. During that entire time, the United States, while aggressive, you know, obviously it invaded Korea, it invaded Vietnam, it carried out sort of endless war all over the world against communist and national liberation forces that were ascendant during that period. The fundamental element of that period for the U.S. foreign policy was essentially defensive,
right,
which seems contrary when you think, well, they were invading Vietnam and invading Korea. Those are aggressive acts. But the defensive nature of that period was that the U.S. ruling class, the imperialists, the U.S. capitalism, which had sort of revived world capitalism, which was in the ditch at the end of World War II, feared the advance of communism and socialism as an existential threat to the capitalist order, because socialism was based on public property. The Soviet Union was the anchor of a global movement that was gaining traction, that it was aligned with those colonies, which was the bulk of humanity, who were trying to be independent and free from imperialism. And so the U.S. was trying to contain, well, either roll back or contain this threat to capitalism. It wasn't because the Soviets had aggressive plans. It was because they represented the anchor of a global social system that was irreconcilably contradictory and opposed and antagonistic with imperialism. Right. The aggression that the United States has carried out during the past 20 years or 25 years following the collapse of the Soviet Union is different. The aggressions are largely aggressions of choice. In other words, not trying to stop a global menace. You see the war in Iraq in 1991 hobbled a former Soviet ally. The U.S. intervened in Somalia. The U.S. destroyed a multi-ethnic Yugoslavia through the U.S. And NATO air wars in 1995 and 1999. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001. They consciously decided to smash the Saddam Hussein government in 2003, in spite of the fact that it posed no threat whatsoever, and Saddam would have been perfectly prepared to be a U.S. ally. The U.S. Then fractured Iraq. The U.S. bombing of Gaddafi, after Gaddafi had eliminated all of the weapons of mass destruction that they had, the biological and chemical weapons, as part of a rapprochement or détente between Libya and the West after 2001. The U.S. funding and fueling civil war in Syria starting in 2011, and most notably, aggressively supporting a fascist-led coup d'etat against the government in Kiev in February of this year, of 2014, that overthrew the Yanukovych government. All of these actions have been not as a response to some menace that faced the world capitalist system or the United States per se, but because the United States felt that in the absence of the Soviet Union, it could continue to roll back or remove or carry out regime change, one, against countries that had become independent as a consequence of the anti-colonial project that had been supported by the Soviet Union, and then two, to capture and integrate into an American sphere of influence all of the previous socialist governments in Eastern and Central Europe, and the non-Russian republics of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had 15 republics. Russia was the largest. Ukraine was the second largest. But it included Azerbaijan and Georgia and Armenia and Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Kazakhstan, Turkestan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. All of those Soviet republics also became, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the immediate targets by the United States for their absorption into an American sphere of influence, again, not as a defensive reflex to a Russian menace, but because the U.S. felt Russia was so weak after the collapse of the Soviet Union that U.S. imperialism could opportunistically seize everything and roll back all that it felt was an obstacle to the free flow of American capital. And so the new antagonism between the United States and Russia, unlike the old antagonism, is based on this, that Russia, after a decade of decline and during the Putin period, has, as a large country, a large nuclear country, as a large economy, has gotten back on its feet. And because it has, it constitutes an obstacle to the U.S. expansionist designs in all of these different areas. And we saw that in Syria in last year when the Putin government stood with Syria and tried to find a resolution and in fact did help stop what was then the planned bombing of Syria. I think what happened in the case of Ukraine, which is where the real fundamental breakdown of U.S.-Russian relations developed, I mean, as a sort of sea change where there had been general hostility and tension. What happened in Ukraine is that the United States foreign policy sort of drivers, and those are neoconservatives, Victoria Nuland, John Kerry, before him, Hillary Clinton, they meant to integrate Ukraine, the second largest Soviet country, second largest Soviet republic and Russia's historic ally, directly into the camp of NATO and the EU, in spite of the fact that Yanukovych was prepared to integrate and wanted to integrate Ukraine into Europe economically. He didn't want to do it on the basis of the austerity plan that they were offered, and he refused to allow Ukraine to go into NATO. So using semi-fascist or fully fascist forces like the Right Sector, the U.S. engineered a coup d'etat and supported a coup d'etat that toppled Yanukovych and brought to power a government in Kiev. And that government is determined to bring Ukraine into NATO. That's an existential threat to Russia. And Putin or any government in Russia today, as Russia has reasserted itself, would have to stand up. And that, because they did stand up, because they allowed Crimea to come back to Russia, because they supported opposition forces in eastern and southern Ukraine who were against the fascist-inspired government, that's what's caused the complete breakdown in U.S.-Russian relations today, far different from the breakdown during the Soviet period.
Although, you know, there's an interesting parallel there to the Cuban situation. If the Warsaw Pact, for example, were to enlist Mexico as a member back when it existed, it would be viewed as an existential threat by the United States. I mean, we're looking at just the Russian military cooperation and the basing of missiles in Cuba as, you know, reason to go to nuclear war, basically, if necessary. And the U.S. being at the doorstep of Russia in Ukraine has to be looked at in the same way by the Russians.
Yes, indeed. From a Russian point of view, you're absolutely right. From a Russian point of view, Putin cannot, I would say any government in Russia, even if it wasn't Putin, they would have to view this development with great alarm. I mean, after all, when you look at Russian history and Russian/Soviet history, the Ukraine was the base for German aggression in World War I. It was the gateway for the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941 that led to ultimately before the defeat of fascism at the hands of the Red Army, largely, the deaths of 27 million Soviet people.
Right.
Even after World War II ended, I mean, Stalin's real orientation in the areas just to the west of Ukraine, in Poland and Romania, Bulgaria, it wasn't really to socialize those countries, but to create a buffer zone, right, because the Soviet/Russian experience was that these were the areas that were the staging grounds for invasions for the last 150 or 200 years.
Yeah, let me tell you on that point. I was in the Soviet Union in 1990, and Poland had already fallen out of the Soviet orbit, quote-unquote, as they referred to it then. Taking a train from Leningrad to Warsaw, we had to get out of the train at the border and wait while they picked up the car that we rode in and put it on a different carriage, because they used, even with Poland as an ally, they used two different gauges of track so that you couldn't roll trains full of troops into Russia proper, into the Soviet Union from Poland. That's how.
Oh, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. But that's that is a very clear indicator that above and beyond all else, the Russian or Soviet governments historically have viewed this area mainly as a security issue because of the history of using these territories as staging grounds for invasions into Russia proper.
All right, so one last question. Looking at the change in U.S. foreign policy from being defensive in nature, you know, arguably, to that of an active empire, you know, expanding and picking up whatever it can wherever and enforcing empire, these changes are now taking place in the context, you know, I'm talking about with Russia standing up, in the context of that kind of response around the world where you have, you know, regional integration standing up, you know, constructs from regional integration standing up, say, in Latin America and the BRICS countries and the, you know, ascendancy of China's economy, all of that happening where there's not just you can't have these cookies or those cookies, but an alternative structure that's sort of springing into being that could compete with the imperial construct. With these military or hostilities that are taking place between the U.S. and Russia in that context, do you see any dangers?
Yes, I think I would say we're in a very dangerous point. And I want to, again, just for your listeners, make sure that I'm not misunderstood about when I say the U.S. was essentially pursuing a defensive, what was in a defensive mode during the Cold War, because it, as part of its defensive mode, it aggressively, you know, invaded in Korea and 5 million Koreans died, and invaded Vietnam and 2 million Vietnamese died, and it overthrew the government in Iran in 1953 and the Guatemala government in 1954 and invaded Cuba in 1960. In other words, it was very aggressive. But what I meant was that, and just to clarify, is that it was defensive in the sense that U.S. imperialism really did fear the global march of socialism and national liberation, which right. threatened it existentially.
Right.
But back to your question of today, you have the U.S. government, the neoconservatives who drafted the white paper, the famous white paper right after the fall of the Soviet Union, and who outlined the new military strategy, they envisioned a world in which the U.S. would be the unipolar military power. And I emphasize military. They didn't see the United States as having the same economic domination as it had enjoyed after World War II, when most of the capitalist economies were destroyed in the war. But because of U.S. military prowess, that they could make sure that no other competitor would ever dare to challenge American hegemony. That was the doctrine. And that has, in essence, been the operational doctrine. But we see over the last 20 years that India has developed economically, that China has developed economically, that Brazil has grown so much, that South Africa, free from the constraints of apartheid, has become a major economic power in Africa and beyond. So you have the rise of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, who are seeking methods and ways to coordinate with each other and to rival the complete economic and military domination of imperialism.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.